You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProcPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Tuesday edition. We have some additional information or an update on that airstrike on the Saudi oil refinery as well as oil fields. The United States is now asserting that it was Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, that was responsible for the attack, and it involved cruise missiles as well as drones, and it most likely came from an Iranian air base right near Iraq, and it probably flew over these both missiles and drones flew over Iraq and Kuwait. So they're coming from the north, not the south. Yemen is in the south, and the rebels are in the northwestern portion of Yemen. The government controls about half, and let's say 30 to 40% of the rebel areas. Given the distances involved, it looks like for certain that it is Iran, but you need proof, and they have some proof. They think the missile is a Quds 1, and there's an Iranian model of that. That's the Quds 1 is what the Yemen had, but it looks at, and that's based on a version of a missile that the Iranians had. So it's more and more, it looks like it's definitely, they weren't using a proxy this time. They thought they could get away with it. And obviously the defenses of the Saudi Air Force were looking south to Yemen and not looking in the direction where these missiles were coming from. So what's going to happen? I don't think you're going to get a decision on what and who should do it. Frankly, I'm a non-interventionist. What I mean by that, I don't think the United States should be intervening in country after country. We sell arms to Saudi Arabia. We sell F-15s, a lot of equipment, a lot of bombs, missiles, and fighter jets. They have, if not the largest, no longer the largest, but for many, many decades, it was the largest oil reserves. That's where they get their money from. And they rely on that money to provide subsidies to their people. It's very much a welfare state, and that's how they control their people. They get checks. To stay in power, it's absolutely critical that the Saudi monarchy continue the flow of oil that they're selling, and most of that oil is going to either Japan or Communist China, some to Europe, a little of it, but not much. Maybe one tanker a month goes to the United States. So in terms of who buys this oil, those are the countries that can be most impacted by the fact that the refinery will be down. Now, the Saudi government is saying they're going to get it back up as quick as possible, and maybe as much as a third to a half will be back within a week. I think that's optimistic, but let's see what happens. So it's definitely going to have an impact, definitely, on world petroleum prices, and in turn that will impact gasoline prices. It's important to understand that The world petroleum market is primarily dominated by states. As a matter of fact, the United States is one of the few countries where they don't control the oil reserves. Its independent companies have the property rights to it. And because we've discovered a lot more petroleum as well as natural gas, we're not totally independent. If we wanted to be independent, we could. But we certainly are now an exporter of both gasoline as well as oil around the world, and increasingly natural gas, liquefied natural gas. But gas prices are definitely going up, and that's really the second story. They're having an impact on world prices anywhere from 10, 20, maybe even 30 cents. Depends where you're at. There's obviously a lot of speculation. I think this will all calm down once the Saudis get their refineries back up and they're shipping and filling tankers that get them that revenue flowing again. So the impact on the American people, at least initially, will be slightly higher gasoline prices at the tank. I think over time, though, that will they'll go back down. It's just wait and see. And that's why President Trump, we have a strategic reserve, wants to use that to hopefully lower gasoline prices. Very much wait and see what the Saudi government is going to do. They have a large air force, but in terms of population, like I said last show, it's more than 3-1 in terms of the Iranians, in terms of people. And you got to always consider the religious angle. The Saudi government, remember, they have Mecca, Medina, where people go from around the world that are Muslims every year. So they want to keep that open. And if they were to go to war, it would be, I mean, an all-out war. It's going to take other countries to assist them. And obviously they're looking to the United States, but also Egypt, because that Egypt has the manpower. But will Egypt get involved? Well, if they want oil, they will. Remember, right on the Red Sea at Yanbu, a pipeline goes from these oil fields to which are in the northeast part of the country to the middle of the country on the west coast, and then some of this oil goes through the Red Sea, and that would supply Egypt. So it's clear that I think the Saudi monarchy is going to strike back. But the question is, what's going to be the target? The obvious target is where the air base where these drones and missiles came from. But they need to escalate it a little bit and really take out some of the production capability of Iran. And I think that's what you're going to see. It's going to be a two-prong attack, both on the source of this attack, and that would be the air base, the missile sites, as well as the drone sites and fighter aircraft at that base as well. And the radars, but also take out some of Iran's oil fields and production. And then the question is, what will happen? Will Iran escalate? Now, they've already said they will. If you come attack us, we're going to come back. It's a war, folks. Let's cut to the chase. What we're talking about here is the distinct possibility of an escalating war. And then the $64 question is, who will be the allies of the Saudi Arabia and who will provide the fighting men and women, and primarily men in this case, to attack the Iranians? And what will Iran do? Because if Iran attacks U.S. forces, then you're looking at a World War III has begun. Because who are the major backers of Iran? It's Russia and Communist China. Keep that in mind. So this is a very dangerous situation. I don't think Trump wants to be the one to do the attacking. I think he's going to very much let the Saudis do what they think is an appropriate response. The only problem you get into, it could be quickly an escalating type war. And if it does, I think Iran mistakenly would go after U.S. forces. And once that happens, the United States is in. I think Donald Trump has made it very, very clear, if you attack our military people, our vessels, our aircraft, he's coming after you. That's my interpretation of his lock and load comment Sunday. So it's really in the hands of Saudi Arabia and what will be the response of Iran. But I think Saudi Arabia is definitely going to be coordinating this with the United States. And don't forget Israel either. The election is still up in the air. I think Netanyahu will still be prime minister of Israel for another at least 6 months. I'm assuming they can't get you need 61 votes to control the Knesset. So we'll see how that turns out. But it looks like it's going to be a very close race, if not a tied race. So that's what's happening in the Middle East. And guess what? We live in a world economy, and it does impact the United States, especially you and me at the gas pump, and will impact our armed forces if, and I think it's likely, we're going to see conflict. The question is, can it be kept circumscribed, in other words, limited, or will this be an all-out war? This is war, folks. And as I said in previous shows, there's no love between the Persian Shia Muslims and the Arab Sunni Muslims. And what Iran has been doing is using proxies in Yemen, the Houthis in Syria, the Hezbollah, and their allies with Syria. Keep that in mind. But they use Hezbollah to do the fighting, but they provide the arms. And then you have Lebanon as well. The Hezbollah is there as well, and they are enemies of Israel. So Iran has a well-deserved reputation for being a terrorist nation and using proxies, and that's what we have here. They at least initially try to convince the Saudis that this strike came from Yemen. And initially, that was the typical reaction. Whoever did this probably, and it's probably the Houthis, and the Houthis claim responsibility. But the United States has many sources of intelligence that other governments don't have, and we got to protect our sources here. It's clear that Pompeo, when he visits the Crown Prince, is going to tell him, listen, here's what we know, and you were attacked by Iran, and then it's up to the Saudi monarchy to decide what they're going to do. And I think they're going to want to strike back. They're going to want to use, remember, they spent a lot of money, billions of dollars over many, many years, buying military equipment from not only the United States, but also from Europe. So they have the arms, they have the military armaments that they need. What they don't have is a big army. And that's where I think if there is a coordinated attack on Iran, even if it's a limited response, they might seek troops from other countries. And I think it would be Egypt. I don't think the United States is not going to want to be the one to first do this strike. It's not that the United States couldn't do it. We have assets right along the coast on the west bank of the Persian Gulf, and the Iranians are on the other side. So it's not that we don't have, we have a Navy base, an Air Force base, and there's equipment there. Plus, we have our carrier task force, not in the Persian Gulf, but outside, that could launch, again, an air attack or a missile attack. And I think if we got involved, we would most likely launch cruise missiles at the oil refineries and oil and natural gas of Iran along right in the Persian area. Remember, most of the cities of Iran are north. What we're talking here is those close to Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. And it's the Strait of Hormuz where tankers have to go through. So all the fingers are pointing now at Iran, and we'll be awaiting a response. I don't think you're going to see it right away, because there's President Trump is going to the United Nations, and he's going to meet with our allies there. And they're going to try to get the United Nations to do something. And the question is, what will be? If it's just words condemning Iran, I don't think that's going to be it's not going to have a great of an impact. Donald Trump, if he wants to get involved in this to a large extent, he needs to build a coalition. And that simply takes time and convincing, because we should seek NATO as well as the United Kingdom. And remember, some of those countries have not been putting up their minimum of 2%, although Donald Trump has been insisting on it, and some have increased their military spending. And it's not clear NATO would get involved with this. It really, in my mind, you need to focus on, do they have strong evidence to prove this? Proof will be key. And remember, the United States, how can you forget, made a strong case that Iraq had nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Well, they didn't have nuclear weapons. They did have chemical and biological weapons, but they never found the nuclear weapon. Let me make clear, there will be a lot of skepticism on part of many nations, and it will be up to the United States and Saudi Arabia to convince other nations that they have the evidence. And yes, people are going to assume depending on which side. If you're obviously on the United States side, the Saudi side, the Israeli side, you blame the Iranians. Conversely, the Iranians would say, wait a minute, this was a clear response to Saudi Arabia over the last several years attacking the Houthis in Yemen. So both sides are finger-pointing. It's the evidence, folks. So I think there will be a response from Saudi Arabia and maybe other nations, but I don't think it's going to happen overnight. Now, there are many Americans that I listen to talk radio want to go there and bomb the hell out of them. Well, there's a problem with that. The majority of the American people don't want it. And it's not our war. Like I said, there are religious differences as well as ethnic differences between the Arab Sunni Saudis and the Persian Shia Iranians. That's why the problem with intervention, usually the American people and most of the people in the government simply don't know the history, the customs, traditions, the background, the culture of the nations that we go in and sometimes free. And invariably what happens over time, the people that we so-called liberate turn against us. And we get stuck in nations for years, like in Afghanistan. It's going on 19 years. Why are we there? Why are we there? The Soviets retreated, so did the British. And we need to pull out, bring the troops home. We've provided a lot of training, a lot of arms to the Afghan government. The problem with the Afghan government, as well as our government, you have bought and paid politicians. You have corrupt politicians. So Iran and what happened to the Saudi refineries and oil fields is going to be in the news. We'll learn more. But there's been a definite, it went from most likely it's the Iranians to now the United States clearly stating it is the Iranians, and they're identifying where they think the missiles and the drones came from. It did damage. The question is, how serious is the damage? And it's that much is wait and see. Now, if these repairs can be made very quickly with a minimum loss of production, I don't think they're going to get back to 100%, though, in a couple of weeks. I think this is months, maybe even a year. But they could get a significant portion of their production, and it's 5.7 million barrels a day before the airstrike, and that's been cut back. But remember, the Saudis have reserves, so there's sort of a race to get as quickly back to that 5.7 million figure. And remember, this petroleum has to go through the Persian Gulf if it's going to Japan or Communist China and other nations in the Far East. Most of this petroleum is going to petroleum-poor nations, developing nations, but some large nations. Japan is definitely a industrialized state. They are very dependent on petroleum from around the world. They don't have any, so they got to import it all. And more or less the same for Communist China. Well, that's about as much as I want to say, and I already said oil, gasoline prices are up. I would give it a week to see. It depends where you live and how much taxes are, but around the country, it's definitely up. See where it is a week from now, a month from now, and if what the Saudis are saying, that they can make these repairs and get the oil refining production back up to where it was, then maybe in a month, I think it'll be slightly higher, but not much. And that would be good for the U.S. economy. The worst thing that could happen is this 5.7 million would be offline for a year or more. That would definitely have an impact and might even put the world economy in a recession. But it's too early to tell. That's the key thing. I think you have to see how long it takes to get production back and to see what will be the response of the Saudis to this attack. I think they're going to respond. They're not just going to sit there and let it happen. They were attacked. This was a clear act of war. You can see the smoke from space. So Iran is still... Why is Iran doing this? The regime is getting desperate. They're deliberately trying to provoke a war with not only Saudi Arabia, but with the United States to unify their country. It's the people of Iran that the regime really fears. They're hurting, folks, because of the sanctions the United States has imposed on Iran. And keep that in mind. You know, what I hope for, but it's purely hope on my part, is the people of Iran and rise up and overthrow this regime. But like I said last show, who controls all the weapons? It's the regime controls all the weapons. So unless you can get weapons to eliminate, and I mean kill, the regime, the principals in the regime, both in the army, the armed forces, as well as the politicians, it's the Mullers that are the problem, and it's a very, very corrupt system. Corruption is needed to get things done. When I say corruption, I'm talking bribery. From their point of view, these people are hanging on, and they need money because they're not selling the oil and natural gas that they did before. What else is in the news? Well, we learned that Governor Cuomo has ordered the ban of e-cigarettes, vapor products, from sale in New York. Now, a little background. I'm not a smoker. I think when I was maybe a teenager, I tried it once, coughed, and said, no way am I going to do this. This is a waste of money. It's not good for my health. And I had a father that was a two-pack-a-day Marlboro man. But my mother didn't smoke. And I'll be honest, what I really didn't like, and I saw it, the smell and the fact that my father's hands were yellow from nicotine stains. And he tried to quit many times, finally did it when he was in his 50s. I think late 50s, when a friend of his dropped dead of a heart attack that was a smoker. He was helping him with, some construction on his house, and guy collapsed, and he had a heart attack, and that caused my father to stop. Unfortunately, when you smoke for that many years, and he had been smoking for over 30 or 40 years, I don't know when he started, it does do damage to your arteries and blocks them, and eventually he died of a heart attack. He had quit smoking. He was definitely losing weight, but heart attack catches up to you. And that's what you got to consider, the long-term health risk. But you see, when my father started smoking, and people of his generation, he was the World War II generation, the armed forces would give you cigarettes and say it was healthy. The thing to do was to smoke. And down the road, when these people continued to smoke, that's when they got strokes and heart attacks and cancer. But it was popular for that entire generation and into my generation. It's really been in the last, I would say, 10 to 20 years that smoking is definitely not as popular. Now, where is it popular? And I'm not crying for the tobacco companies. It's in the less developed nations. That's where they're making their money. In Africa, for example, in Asia. They're smokers, folks, and even parts of Europe. Smoking is declining over the years in the United States for various reasons. Nicotine is one of the most addictive substances. It's hard to get off of it. That's why many people that have tried and tried have switched to what? E-cigarettes. Now, I'm going to play briefly a clip that really, I'm thinking of playing two, but I'm definitely going to play one to give you the overall background. And I recommend, for those that are new listeners, the way you listen to the Pronk Pop Show is to go to my companion blog. That's pronkpops.wordpress.com. And underneath my photograph, you'll see links. That's how you listen to the show of the most recent 60 to 80 shows. But under that, you have not all, but a lot of my show prep. And that's a lot of videos, articles, cartoons, charts, statistics, whatever's relevant. And I do this for every show, every story. I provide you additional information. I look at all of this information, try to boil it down. I'm not reading from a script, but I immerse myself in this, and it's very much stream of conscious, but it's focused on what the news stories are. And if you go down, this is the very, very first video, and I'm going to play the audio. This is a Prager University video. It's had over 5 million hits. This is a very, very, in my mind, there are two videos here, and I might play both of them because I think this is important. I'm not a smoker, never have been, didn't smoke pot either. Oh yeah, I tried it once, so what? I didn't like it. It smelled, and yeah, I coughed. I definitely am not familiar with vaping or smokers' problems, but Cuomo banned it. Why? The reason given was that young people, and I can see this, and I did a lot of research into this, listening to this, people that use this, the primary where it really makes sense is for people that want to try to quit smoking. because vaping, contrasting with smoking, smoking is deadly because you're burning chemicals that cause cancer. Vaping, you're not burning anything. What we see as smoke is vapor coming out. And it's flavored. Mango, berry flavor, bubblegum flavor. And see, that's what's attracting the kids. Many of the kids don't understand. And it really depends on what your, I want to say hardware, what device you're using. I need to give you some background. What's the issues here? I've decided I'm going to play both of these videos. I normally don't do this, but they're both so good, you need the background. So this one's, what's worse, vaping or smoking? I'll tell you the answer. What's far worse, far deadly, is smoking. The only problem I see with vaping is not all, but many of these e-cigarettes have nicotine in it. That's why people that are smokers buy this. You can actually get e-cigarettes that don't have nicotine in it. And you, the reason why you like it is the flavors. That's the one thing I hear over and over. They want this flavor, that flavor. So without further ado, what's worse, vaping or smoking? Well, you be the judge.
Imagine if there were an alternative to smoking cigarettes. Imagine this alternative could help millions of people quit smoking and came with only a fraction of the harmful chemicals that cigarettes do. Well, you don't have to imagine it. It exists. E-cigarettes are the most innovative and promising smoking cessation product yet invented. So public health officials and anti-tobacco activists are all in favor of this life-saving innovation, right? Actually, they're almost all totally against it. Why? Because, incredibly, they make no substantial distinction between e-cigarettes and real cigarettes, even though they are completely different products. To begin with, e-cigarettes aren't cigarettes. They contain no tobacco. Instead, a liquid containing nicotine derived from tobacco leaves is vaporized, and users of e-cigarettes inhale that vapor. Vapor, mind you, not smoke. This is significant because the real harm from tobacco comes from the combustion process, which releases hundreds of toxic compounds known as tar. Since e-cigarettes have no tobacco and no combustion, they release no tar. This makes them, according to Britain's Department of Health, at least 95% less harmful than tobacco cigarettes. E-cigarettes do contain nicotine, an addictive drug. However, there's little evidence that nicotine alone is bad for you, making it similar to, say, caffeine, a drug used every day by millions of people. Brad Rodeau, an oral cancer specialist at the University of Louisville, put it this way. I love coffee, and I'm sure I could get caffeine if I smoked my coffee beans. But I would be paying a much different price in overall health if I did. In other words, when it comes to addictive substances like caffeine or nicotine, it isn't the addictive substance that's harmful, it's how it's delivered. As South African psychiatrist Mike Russell said about cigarettes, people smoke for the nicotine, but they die from the tar. And again, there's no tar in e-cigarettes. Does this all mean that e-cigarettes are completely safe? Of course not. Nothing is completely safe. E-cigarettes are a relatively new innovation, so more research is needed, especially on long-term effects. There's also a place for sensible regulation to ensure consumer safety. But unlike normal everyday products, any potential risk posed by e-cigarettes is far outweighed by a real, not potential, good. Saving lives by providing the nicotine that smokers enjoy without delivering the deadly toxins that can kill them. Many former smokers have successfully used e-cigarettes to help them kick their nicotine addiction altogether. A recent study in an Oxford Journal peer-reviewed publication, Nicotine and Tobacco Research, said that e-cigarettes could reduce smoking-related deaths by 21%. That's thousands of lives every year. John Britton, an epidemiologist and director of the University of Nottingham's Center for Tobacco and Alcohol Studies, is even more optimistic. E-cigarettes are the first genuinely new way of helping people stop smoking that has come along in decades. They have the potential to help half or more of all smokers get off cigarettes. So again, you'd think public health officials and anti-tobacco groups would be doing everything they could to encourage smokers to switch to e-cigarettes. Instead, they push for laws and rules that equate the two products. Cigarettes are bad, so e-cigarettes must also be bad. As of August 2016, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has ruled that all e-cigarettes must go through a long and expensive application process. This process could end up costing as much as $1 million per new product. While some of the biggest manufacturers will be able to shoulder the costs and navigate the regulatory mess, most small e-cigarette companies will be forced out of business. With less competition, e-cigarettes will become more expensive, and many people will go right back to smoking. E-cigarette prohibitionists may think they're using a better safe than sorry approach to save consumers from some yet-to-be-discovered danger, but they're not. They're actually endangering millions of smokers who would make the switch if the e-cigarette market were allowed to flourish. As Joe Nocera, a New York Times columnist, wrote, equating smoking cigarettes with inhaling e-cigarettes is a huge disservice to public health. On the scale of potential harms, e-cigarettes aren't even in the same ballpark as combustible cigarettes. They have the potential to save millions of lives. The government needs to develop a new paradigm for dealing with e-cigarettes, one that ensures basic standards but recognizes their relative safety and immense benefit to public health. If they don't, more people will die. Imagine that. I'm Caroline Kitchens of the R Street Institute for Prager University.
Now, I don't encourage anyone to either smoke or vape. But I believe adults, and I mean citizens in the United States 18 or older, should have the freedom to choose what they eat, what they drink, and yes, what they smoke or vape. However, you need sensible regulations so to protect children that cannot really make sensible decisions because of their age. I think what's going to happen if this ban in New York spreads, and there are several states that want to do this, is many, many teenagers, high school, junior high, will go back to smoking, and they will eventually die and have health impact. I don't think vaping is, and I know, is not the only way to stop smoking. There are drugs, several of them out there, and sometimes they're successful with people, sometimes not. But if you listen to smokers that have switched over, they don't want to go back. You see, nicotine is addictive, but what causes the cancer and the problem, heart disease and strokes, is the fact that your body is consuming. What's entering your body is the tar. Talk to surgeons that operate. So I agree that, especially for adults, they should have the right to continue using e-cigarettes. I'm sitting out on a campus. Coming into the campus, they say this is a smoke-free campus. They also now say it's a vapor-free campus. Now, I have no problem with that because why? I don't smoke. I never liked it. But I used to work in many places where, and this is 20, 30 years ago, where people were smoking. And I mean big offices, huge. And you could see we had white, you know, we had a lot of cubicles, and the dividers were white. And what would happen? You could see the stain, yellow stains from nicotine. Like I said, this is many years ago when people could still smoke in the workplace. But we've learned a lot, and we've educated people, and it's hard to change a habit that's very addictive, and nicotine is addictive, and that's one of my problems even with the cigarette. You're going to still be addicted to nicotine, but you're not going to get, and that can have an impact on your brain, for example. But we really have no studies, no real information on this yet. So I lean towards the government should stay out of it, especially for adults. The only area that I have a concern, and it's a difficult situation, for the simple reason, if you make it impossible for high school, junior high, and even earlier, kids, teenagers getting e-cigarettes, what are they going to do? They're going to go, many of them, not all of them, but a lot of them will go to smoking. You see, today, many of the people that are attracted to e-cigarette, mainly because of the flavors, the taste, the flavors, might go back to cigarette. I hope they don't. But if they get started, they probably, many of them, will be addicted to nicotine the rest of their life. But they won't get the impact that from the tars. It's the combustion of the tobacco, the paper and the chemicals in it when you smoke that kill you. It's not the nicotine doesn't kill you. The reason you keep wanting to smoke is you want the nicotine. The same thing with the cigarettes. You're still going to be addicted. But the huge health effects, negative health effects of smoking cigarettes, you avoid. Now, I want to play one more video on this. And this is more an academic one. This is a Professor Andrea King, PhD, I believe it's the University of Chicago. And this gives you, I think, a very objective pros and cons. Let's listen to her.
Hello, this is Dr. Andrea King. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago, and I specialize in addictions. And today I'm going to present a webinar on electronic cigarettes, the facts and the myths. So we're all well aware of the monthly and weekly headlines we see about e-cigarettes in terms of they may be helpful, they may be harmful, they may hurt our children and youth, and they may also be a great way to quit smoking. And so we see these, and that really adds to our confusion. What I'm going to talk about today is to give you an overview of the products. What are they? What is their harm and safety? What are the rates in youth? What's the current data show? Do they help with quitting smoking, or might they increase smoking? And also some bottom line in terms of what you can convey to your students, your trainees, your patients, and your colleagues about these products. So we have 460 e-cigarette products and counting. They're increasing every month. What we've seen is first-generation products that really resembled closely what a regular cigarette, combustible cigarette, looks like. You can see them here on the left. And the field has evolved now to second and third generation products called vaporizers, vape pens, or mods. And they vary in their look and feel to customize to the user. The devices and the e-liquids are not regulated. The FDA currently has not regulated these products, so it's unclear the constituents and the differences in the voltage and the nicotine delivery one might get. But we do know that second and third generation products are becoming more popular among users. So many people will start with the Cigalike and quickly gravitate to the second and third generation devices. They report they do that to get a more satisfying nicotine hit, to get the flavors and the customization of the experience. So the e-cigarette components can get to a lot of complicated chemistry. What I've done here is to break it down into three essential portions. And we have the inhalation portion, where you breathe into the device. We have the middle portion, which is where the heating comes by, the atomizer and the battery to heat the liquids and to help you have a vapor to inhale. And then we have a tip portion, in some cases may simulate a regular cigarette. Usually in second and third generation devices, they don't. And so a user will inhale the aerosol and then exhale it out into the environment. So what's in the e-liquids that you put into an e-cigarette? Well, these vary, and it's unregulated, so we're not sure of the proportions. But what we do know is that there's four main elements. We have the base, which contains, may or may not contain nicotine at different levels. So it can contain no nicotine. The product might say it contains a lower level of nicotine, that equivalent of a half a pack of cigarettes, or it could be at 36 milligram per mils, which is much higher than you would get even in a pack of cigarettes. We have a base, which often contains the chemicals propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin. And they're there to create that satisfying hit, to help augment the flavors. And they're also there to create the expired aerosol and the vape that we see. The flavors can also vary so much in the chemicals. Diacetyl and propionyl and other chemicals can help to enhance the buttery feeling and the satisfaction for the person using an e-cigarette. And as many of you have seen, they can range from the traditional tobacco and menthol flavors and also to things like rum, cotton candy, Coke, bubble gum, and things like that that may particularly appeal to youth. And there's other water and additives. Again, as an unregulated product, we don't know the amounts, and the health and safety of these products in terms of inhaling them is unknown. So e-cigarettes have exploded in the last 10 to 15 years. They were invented in 2003 by a Chinese pharmacist named Han Lick. And within a few years, they were open to the United States and European markets. They were not allowed to claim themselves as a smoking cessation device because they don't have evidence for that. But rather, they claim to be a freedom of product or maybe a less harmful product for a smoker to use. There's been a sharp increase in use. So recently, we see about 13% of adults have tried e-cigarettes. In 2010, that was about 2% of adults. And we see the rates are much higher in people who are smokers. So most users of e-cigarettes currently are people who are current smokers and may go back and forth from products, but also never in former smokers attribute to about 20 to 30% of people who do use e-cigarettes. In terms of race ethnicity, the use is highest among whites and American Indians, non-Hispanic, and in younger people. So 18 to 25-year-olds are often the highest users. Certainly under age 40, we see the highest proportion of people using e-cigarettes. It is forecasted that e-cigarette sales will outsell traditional cigarettes within the next 10 years, given the increases in their popularity. The main concern is, what about our youth? So in middle and high schoolers, e-cigarette use now surpasses that of any other tobacco product. So cigarillos, little cigars, and hookah, and regular combustible cigarettes, we see e-cigarette use the most prevalent. From 20 to 13 alone, there was a tripling of e-cigarette use in our youth, with now over 2.5 million kids and adolescents being exposed to the products. Data from last year show higher past month use of e-cigarettes versus regular combustible cigarettes at all grade levels. We can see here in 8th grade, 1 in 10 8th graders has used an e-cigarette compared to 4% with a regular cigarette. And we see this also in the 10th and 12th grades with higher e-cigarette use. So the popularity among youth is increasing. Another cause for concern has been recent evidence that youth can also vaporize alcohol or cannabis they can put in that e-liquid chamber, and those don't have the odor. So the youth may be using the products and smoking marijuana and not detected because there's not as much odor. So e-cigarettes, are they positive or negative? Well, the proponents would suggest that this could be the end game for combustible tobacco use. I don't think anyone would argue that combustible tobacco use has caused a lot of death and disease in our society. They're proposing that e-cigarette use, if everyone switched over, would help our population health. They also say they could aid in smoking cessation, although that's yet to be determined, and may play a role in harm reduction. So if we can remove the tar and the carbon monoxide and some of the carcinogens that are present in a combustible cigarette by replacing them with an e-cigarette, we could at least reduce the harm in society. The opponents, people opposed to e-cigarettes, say they may reduce people's use of approved medications. We have 7 different medications that have been shown to double or triple your chances of quitting smoking. We don't have evidence for e-cigarettes, so it may reduce people actually getting access to approved treatments. It has potential for long-term consequences in terms of, we don't know the effects of these chemicals on your body long-term, and it could continue the addiction to nicotine. And it could increase smoking behaviors in youth and renormalize smoking. We've worked very hard in tobacco control to eliminate smoking in a lot of public places, but having people vaping may actually change that. So we all know more research is needed to support or refute these claims, but the confusion still dominates. Do they help smokers quit? This is a question I get a lot, and it's really unclear. There are few studies out there, few well-conducted studies, and there's methodological problems in the ones that are out there. The studies that are out now haven't really randomized participants to different conditions. They don't contain a control group. They may have small sample sizes, or they use products that lack quality, so we're not sure what the smokers trying to quit were actually getting in the e-cigarette product. So the quit rates in these studies generally have ranged from 5 to 7%, and that's actually what you would see in an unaided quit attempt by a smoker. Most people who are using the product, as I said before, are dual users. They go back and forth from using an e-cigarette to a regular cigarette, although there is a small minority that might completely switch from tobacco smoking to an e-cigarette use, maybe 5% of smokers so far. A recent review concluded that people who use e-cigarettes to quit smoking actually have a lower odds of quitting smoking. And why might this be? It's an important issue because if you look at the form and the function of an e-cigarette, it's so similar and may trigger somebody to want to smoke. And so that's been the source of some of the research that we've conducted in my group at the University of Chicago. We look on this slide, and we have to take a minute to find which is the tobacco smoke and which is the e-cigarette product. So in our work, in short, we've looked at exposure to e-cigarette use in young adults who are smokers, and they're in an environment in our laboratory where they are exposed to somebody else using the products or they're seeing an advertisement. So we've looked at the Cigalike product, where you're in a room engaging in conversation with somebody using an e-cigarette. We did the vape pen, vaporizer, same paradigm, and we also had young people looking at advertisements. In all our studies, we have a control condition where they also look at somebody using a bottled water or using a combustible cigarette. And so what we see here is our results on desire for an e-cigarette. And what we see is that when we expose somebody to somebody drinking water, their desire for an e-cigarette does not increase over time. But when they're exposed to a combustible cigarette, they show minimal increase in desire for an e-cigarette. When they see somebody using the vape pen what we found is a substantial increase in their desire to use an e-cigarette, even if they weren't regular e-cigarette users already. What was surprising to us was that the desire for a regular cigarette increased regardless of the product. So here we see the minimal increase in desire to smoke when you see somebody drink water. But we see in both the group exposed to a regular combustible cigarette smoking and those exposed to the e-cigarette, we see a significant increase that's similar from combustible to regular cigarette smoking. And it remains high 20 minutes after that exposure. So the bottom line, what do you tell people? Well, there's widespread confusion due largely to the explosion of use and the lack of having regulation of products. So we really have folklore prevailing over the science right now, unfortunately. We have little understanding of the nicotine content, the additives, the voltages, the long-term harm, the safety, or potential benefits in society. It's unclear whether e-cigarettes are a gateway for kids to start smoking and using other tobacco products or other substances. But we do know that the most widely used tobacco product now in youth at middle and high school levels are e-cigarettes. We do know that the flavorings, when you have bubble gum and candy and other flavors, that's very appealing to youth. And we also know that there's increasing use of cannabis and alcohol that can be vaped. So there may be cause for alarm. And finally, I'd like to point out that tobacco companies are increasingly investing in e-cigarette products. So we've had decades of maybe potentially lack of a science base and information to the public on cigarettes. And so it may give us reason to pause knowing that tobacco companies are now getting involved in e-cigarettes.
Shortly after filming our webinar, the FDA announced that there would be a new ban on sales going beyond those of cigarettes to persons under age 18 to also now include e-cigarettes, little cigars, and other tobacco products. In my opinion, this is an important step that will reduce access and sales to youth, and it will also inform us about the chemicals that are in the products, which are now obfuscated in a cloud of smoke, in other words. Here are details of the FDA regulation announcement in May, and the main aspects include prohibiting e-cigarette sales to persons under age 18, requiring manufacturers of existing products to register and report the ingredients and potentially harmful constituents. New products would need to undergo extensive authorization review, and there will be health warnings on packaging and advertisements.
So I'd like to thank you for your time in this webinar. If you have any other questions, you can feel free to contact me. Here is my email address, and here is my direct telephone line. And I thank you for your time and attention.
So if you go to my companion blog for the show, promptpops.wordpress.com, you can review and get more information on both of these video clips, audio clips that I just played. But there are a lot more. There's different sides to this. I'm not picking a side. Other than, yes, I think you need to protect children, teenagers. Their brain is not fully formed. They're developing. But you know, and I know, because we once were teenagers or children, and usually you get it from a friend or take it from your parent that was smoking. Kids, especially males for some reason, but it was women too, females, tried smoking. Many stopped after the first time. The one thing I noticed with vaping, people try it the first time and they have a coughing fit. I mean, a serious coughing fit. Now, over time, they don't have that problem or less of it. And that's the one memory I have of the one or two, I think two times I tried it. And I coughed my head off and thanks, but no thanks. And the same thing in college. You go to a party, someone would pass you a joint. A lot of paranoid people, I didn't particularly like it, didn't want them to freak out. I would puff and pass it on. I don't like smoking. But people should be free to put in their body what they want. And some of the things that you put in your body will harm you. The biggest health problem in the United States is not smoking. And really, it's not drinking. What is it? It's obesity. It's people overeating and not exercising enough. And that's by far the biggest risk factor. Now, we don't see a rush to ban foods, although we do have some mayors that would limit your choices. Sensible regulation, yes, but out-and-out bans I don't think will work. Remember Prohibition? Did that work? No. A lot of people were killed because it became illegal and the mafia provide the liquor. But after Prohibition was repealed, now there are liquor stores all over and people can consume liquor. And yes, drunk drivers are a big problem. They're killers. But people think they can control their consumption of alcohol and do it. We don't ban alcohol. We don't really ban cigarettes. We limit their sale to adults, whatever the drinking or smoking age is. I have no problem with that if the people of each state have no problem with that. Adults, in my mind, should be free to consume what they want, understanding they're taking and will be taking risk. And that includes not only what you drink, what you eat, and yes, what you smoke, and now what you vape. And I'll leave it there. Like I said, I'm not an expert on vaping. Don't pretend to be. But I would allow adults, especially those that are smokers, and most of them are, that are trying to quit. This elite vaping nicotine. Remember, it's a vapor. The electrical coil is heating up a liquid that when you inhale it, you're inhaling a vapor that you exhale. And that's why it looks like you're smoking, because you exhale a cloud. Some people actually want a bigger and bigger cloud, but it's not smoke. And that's the big difference. Because if you continue to smoke day in, day out over many long years, yeah, your hands will turn yellow, your lungs will turn black, and eventually it catches up to you in a heart attack, lung cancer, or a stroke. And if you combine it with being overweight, the health risks are terrific. I always am surprised that very few politicians, as a matter of fact, you really have to look hard, talk about the number one health problem, namely obesity. But smoking and e-cigarettes is the people that want to control you and me and what we can choose to buy are always out there. I call them the busybody. The only exception, and that's why I say common sense regulation, you need to protect children. And I mean young children, including teenagers. But once they become an adult, in my mind at 18, others would argue 21, they're on their own. They need to make the choices, hopefully informed choices. I'm not recommending you become an alcohol abuser, a cigarette abuser, in other words, become addicted to it, because it will ruin your health. And the same with e-cigarettes. You will become addicted, but the health impacts will be significantly less. Now, I had one other story. I'm not going to spend but a minute on this. Congress, if you listen to the news, and I'm sure they've had several stories on this, they're conducting an impeachment probe. An impeachment probe, the House Judiciary, under Nadler. They want to impeach Trump. They have a problem. What did he do wrong? And that is the problem. You're supposed to have articles of impeachment, charges, if you will. And an impeachment is like an indictment. You're charging someone. In a criminal manner, you're indicting him for committing a crime. Then it has to go be prosecuted, and a jury has to decide whether the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But in Congress, and they changed the rules on this one, they let one of the staff question, almost always, it's who? The representatives or senators. The problem with that, and I've been critical of that, is it's not a cross-examination. So this time they changed the rules, and they subpoenaed, and the person showed up, and it was the early part of the campaign when Trump was still a candidate, his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. I know I'm mispronouncing his name. I apologize to him. But he testified, and he gave it back to him, I guess is the best way to say it. Now, he wasn't answering a lot of questions, and he would always say, okay, tell me what page or paragraph in the Mueller report you're referring to. Well, they wanted an open-ended type questioning. The White House said, no, we're invoking executive privilege, and this gentleman's conversation with the president is off base. Executive privilege means you can't question a person about his advice that he gave either the candidate or the president. When a president invokes that, and he did have a White House counsel with him, he's not going to answer the question. And that frustrated the representative. You see, in my mind, okay, if you want to impeach someone, then draft articles of impeachment and see if you can get enough people in the House. Now, the House of Representatives is controlled by the Democratic Party. But remember, there are a lot of Democrats, and mainly those that got elected last time, were in districts where Trump won. So they're up for re-election next year. And if they voted to impeach Donald Trump, they're not going to get re-elected. Or a few of them would. So that's the situation. And I think they're just going through the motions to keep this in front of the people. But most people have tuned out and moved on. Once the Mueller report was out, they found no evidence of anyone in the Trump campaign colluding with the Russians. It was over. Frankly, it was over before it got started because they already knew that. This was, in Donald Trump's favorite phrase, a witch hunt. I prefer to call it a fishing expedition. It's the same thing. You see, in the United States of America, you go after people, prosecute people that have committed a crime. That's why, and it's part of the Justice Department, part of their policy is if you're going to have a special counsel, you got to specify the crime. Well, that wasn't done initially. That was done weeks later when it was pointed out, wait a minute, what crime is Donald Trump or anyone in his campaign committed? They were investigating Trump and his people, looking for anything. That's why Donald Trump refers to this as a witch hunt, and it was. Now, I'm just going to play a brief clip. I believe this is the, This is the opening statement. And the representatives were asking questions, but they knew ahead of time that the witness, and this is the first witness, wasn't going to answer them because of the president invoking executive privilege. So let me play for you his opening statement.
Chairman Nadler, Ranking Member Collins, and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'd like to start off by expressing my hope that today's hearing will be productive in revealing the truth, both to the committee and to the American people. For the record, and as you likely know, I have already testified before Congress on three separate occasions. I sat at length with the staff of the special counsel's office. There, too, my time and answers were given freely and without hesitation. I think in one form or another, I have already answered questions for well over 20 hours. So now here I am before the House Judiciary Committee to answer the same questions again. Just last week, this committee, over the objections of the minority, unilaterally changed the rules to make this an impeachment proceeding, which is very unfair. However, in the spirit of cooperation, I am prepared to move forward today. I'd like to start by recounting the events that brought us to this point. My story of joining the Trump campaign, working through a historic election, and continuing to have the privilege to be part of the greatest political movement in our nation's history. I present this summary in the interest of truth and transparency to the American people, the very same reason and rationale that this committee offers as the basis for today's hearing. Growing up in a blue-collar, single-parent family in Lowell, Massachusetts, I learned the value of hard work, and that work ethic helped me to put myself through both college and graduate school, prior to becoming a congressional staffer and ultimately a certified peace officer in the state of New Hampshire. However, the world of politics was always a passion. And in January of 2015, Donald J. Trump, then a private citizen, hired me to help him explore a possible run for the presidency. It was an honor and a privilege to play a small part of such a historic campaign. The campaign started as a small group of individuals helping Mr. Trump to make the decision in June of 2015 to ride down the golden escalator and seek the Republican nomination for presidency of the United States. For more than a year, I served as campaign manager to then-candidate Trump in his historic campaign, where I led a lean and dedicated operation that succeeded in helping him capture the Republican nomination. My job was simple: provide Mr. Trump with my best advice, spend his money like it was my own, and give him the support he needed to win. I also set long-term objectives and managed day-to-day decisions. I had the privilege, and it was a privilege, of helping transform the Trump campaign from a dedicated but small makeshift organization to a historical and unprecedented political juggernaut. And I am proud to say Mr. Trump won 38 primaries and caucuses and received more votes than any candidate in the history of the Republican Party, all while being outspent most of the way. The historic campaign helped Mr. Trump secure the Republican nomination and ultimately the presidency of the United States. However, since Election Day, whether it was bad actors at the FBI and the intelligence community, or lies coming from members of the current House majority that there was evidence of collusion, The American people continue to be sold a false narrative with the purpose of undermining the legitimacy of the 2016 election results. But no matter the size, campaigns are not always the most efficient organizations. And while you run in single congressional districts, just imagine what it's like to lead a national campaign that spans all 50 states of the union. During my time as campaign manager, there were competing interests for the candidate's time and a sea of ideas, some laudable, some sound, a few not so much, many of which were dismissed out of hand. Others were passed on to staffers to be handled. I also received hundreds of thousands of emails, some days with as many as 1,000 emails. And unlike Hillary Clinton, I don't think I ever deleted any of those. Many of them were responded to with either one-word answers or forwarded to other staffers for additional follow-up. But throughout it all, and to the best of my recollection, I don't ever recall having any conversations with foreign entities, let alone any who were offering to help to manipulate the outcome of an election. As I've said publicly many times, anyone who attempted to illegally impact the outcome of an election should spend the rest of their life in jail. And let me stress this fact. During the 2016 election cycle, Mr. Trump held no elected position. He was not a government official. Rather, the Obama-Biden administration and the intelligence community, overseen by James Clapper, Jim Comey, and John Brennan, had the responsibility to the American people to ensure the integrity of the 2016 election. I will leave it to this committee and the American public to decide how successful or not they were in doing their jobs. Regardless, as the special counsel determined, there was no conspiracy or collusion between the Trump campaign and any foreign governments, either on my watch or afterwards. Not surprisingly, after the Mueller report was made public, interest in the fake Russia collusion narrative has fallen apart. In conclusion, and it's sad to say, this country has spent over 3 years and $40 million taxpayer dollars on these investigations, and it's now clear that the investigation was populated by many Trump haters who had their own agenda to take down a duly elected president of the United States. As for actual collusion or conspiracy, there was none. What there has been, however, is harassment of this president from the day he won the election. We as a nation would be better served if elected officials like yourself concentrated your efforts to combat the true crises facing our country, as opposed to going down rabbit holes like this hearing. Instead of focusing on petty and personal politics, the committee focused on solving the challenges of this generation. Imagine how many people we could help, or how many lives we could save. As I stated earlier, I have voluntarily appeared in front of Congress on 3 separate occasions and spoken to members of the special counsel's office for multiple hours. I will continue to be forthright and cooperative, and I will be as sincere in my answers as this committee is in its questions.
Very well done. Very well done. I'm going to leave it there. If the House Democrats want to impeach Donald Trump, please do, because I think you'll get a backlash from the American people and lose control of the House of Representatives when those Democrats that got elected in districts carried by Trump are thrown out of office. The American people believe, whether you voted for him or not, that President Trump won fair and square. He got the most electoral votes. He needed 270, he got 306, 304 voted for him, and you need to accept it. The problem we have is everyone thought, not everyone, but Democrats thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And because of that, they got arrogant and they broke many laws. And that will be coming out next year when what I call the Clinton-Obama-Democrat criminal conspiracy is exposed in glorious detail. And many of the plotters that broke the law will be facing indictment, prosecution, and if they're found guilty by their jury of their peers, will be going to prison. The American people are demanding it because they do not like the way big lie media, as well as those in Congress, have two sets of rules. The American people believe in the rule of law, but they saw that the fix was in, it was rigged, when what should have happened is Hillary Clinton should have been indicted for her many crimes and wasn't. So stay tuned. In coming months, I think you're finally, after several years now, are going to see the prosecution of that criminal conspiracy. Thank you for listening. And now, America the Beautiful. name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProcPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.